the University of Kentucky as an undergraduate, I looked pretty much like your usual pre-medical student. I'd had a lot of math and science courses. I was fascinated with biology, biochemistry, and I wanted to put my ability to learn that kind of stuff into something that would help people. So I went to medical school. But in retrospect, there might have been a couple of things that made me a little bit different. One was the influence of my mother. My mother has been interested in nutrition for years, well before I ever was. And I learned from her just recently, in fact, that her grandmother, my great-grandmother, was a person in her county in West Virginia that you would go to if you were looking for an herbal remedy for something. So perhaps it runs in my genes to be interested in alternative medicine. But another thing that happened in my first year at Vanderbilt was I was sitting in a lecture one day, and the lecturer mentioned something. He stated something as a fact that I happened to know was a theory because I'd worked in a biochemistry lab that was trying to prove that very point as an undergraduate. Now, it wasn't a fact that, you know, was going to rock the foundations of medicine. It was a very minor issue. But it made me wonder, well, how much of what I'm learning is 100% based on solid evidence, and for that matter, what might be out there that's of value that I don't know about? So it made me a little more open to the idea that not everything of value was taught in medical school. Then in my third year of medical school, something else happened. I was doing my clinical rotations, and I was assigned to an internal medicine team on which there was a doctor named Nicholas Gonzalez. Now, Nick was doing his internship in internal medicine at Vanderbilt, and I learned very quickly from working with him for six straight weeks that he was a very smart doctor, extremely efficient, and good at taking care of his patients. His patients really liked him. But I also learned that he was in the middle of a research project of his very own, and he would talk to anyone who would listen about that research project. And I was one of those people that was willing to listen. Now, he was investigating the work of a man named Dr. William Donald Kelly. Dr. Kelly was an orthodontist by training, and he had been practicing orthodontics in a small town in Texas, and he developed an academic interest in nutrition. And by that, I mean he developed an interest because he noticed that he was straightening the teeth of children whose parents had perfectly straight teeth and had never had braces. So he wondered, well, what's the difference? Why are these straight-toothed parents having crooked-toothed kids? And that got him interested in the work of nutrition and such dentists, for example, as Weston Price, who did a lot of research on that very topic. But it was an academic interest. In other words, Kelly himself was eating a diet of junk food washed down by soft drinks. He wasn't putting anything into practice. And that kind of caught up with him when he was in his late 30s. This would have been in the early 1960s, and he started to lose weight. He lost a massive amount of weight, and he went to see his doctors, and they could not figure out what was wrong with him. Then one day, he looked down at his abdomen, which was now a lot skinnier than it used to be, and he saw there was something sticking out of it. There was a tumor. So he went back to the doctors. He'd been having some issues with his hip, so they did an x-ray, which showed there was something definitely wrong, and they did a physical exam, and then remember, this is the 1960s, no CAT scans, no needle biopsies. They said, you've clearly got cancer, it's in your hip. Most likely it's pancreatic, but we don't know for sure, because the only way to know for sure would be to take you to the operating room, and given that it's already spread, there's really no reason to be doing that. Go home and get your affairs in order. Well, the problem was Kelly's affairs were not in order. It turned out that some payments had been missed on a life insurance policy, and the net result would be that his four young children would be left with nothing if he died. So he did what I might have done in the same circumstances. He called his mother. And his mother's comment was, I'm not going to raise your kids for you. I've already done that. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to come down and see if I can get you better so you can take care of your kids. So the first thing she did when she came down was she threw out all of his junk food. And she put him on a raw vegetarian diet with a lot of nuts and seeds and juices. And she got a goat and put it in the backyard so he could have goat milk, to the mortification of his children, who had to explain to their friends why there was a goat in the backyard. And on this regimen, he stabilized. He wasn't getting better, but he wasn't getting worse. And this was progress, because before that, he'd been going rapidly downhill. So then he was still having some issues with his digestion. And so he thought, well, okay, maybe I need to get some help here. So he went to see a pharmacist. And the pharmacist suggested, why don't you try some pancreatic enzymes? I hear you've got pancreatic cancer. Maybe that could help, because pancreatic enzymes are something that helps you digest food. So he got some pancreatic enzymes and started taking them with his meals, and it really helped, so he took more. And then he decided for some reason to start taking them in between his meals. And what he noticed then was that the tumor that he could feel in his abdomen was changing in character. It was getting softer. It seemed like it was really changing. And so he wondered, you know, being scientifically trained, being a dentist, he said, well, maybe somebody else has thought of pancreatic enzymes in connection with cancer. Went off to the medical library, and he discovered the work of a man named John Beard. Now, John Beard was an embryologist by training. He worked at the University of Edinburgh, and he was very active on the subject of pancreatic enzymes and cancer in the 1900s, 1910s, in that general area. Now, Dr. Beard was an embryologist, which means he was someone who specialized in development from the point when a baby is just a few cells big up until the time of development. So you might wonder, what has that got to do with cancer? Well, what Beard noticed was that there's a certain point where the baby needs to attach to the mother's body. And the early stage of that organ that does that is called the trophoblast. Later, it turns into the placenta. But what he noticed, and what researchers in the last decade or so have also been commenting, is that the trophoblast in its early stages, before it matures into the placenta, looks and acts a lot like a cancer. The trophoblast has to attach to the mother's body and work its way in. It's invasive. Cancer is invasive. It invades into neighboring tissues. The trophoblast has to create a new blood supply for itself. Cancer cells also create a new blood supply. The trophoblast, being that it's made of the baby's genetic makeup, it needs to trick the mother's body into not seeing it as foreign. In other words, it needs to fool the immune system, so to speak. Cancer cells can do that too. And so Beard noticed these similarities between the trophoblast and cancer. But there's one big difference. The trophoblast stops. There comes a point at which it stops invading, stops working its way into the mother's body, and matures into the placenta, which at the time of delivery will just neatly peel off from the mother's body and leave the uterus intact for the next pregnancy. So Beard said, if I can figure out what it is that's giving the trophoblast that signal to stop, maybe I can figure out something that will help with cancer. So he looked at a number of different species, including humans, to try to figure out what that signal might be. And what he found was that in every species he looked at, around the time the trophoblast matured and stopped invading, the baby started making pancreatic enzymes. Now, pancreatic enzymes are used to digest food. But the baby actually, in humans, starts making them around the end of the second month of development. Baby's not going to see a solid meal, or a liquid meal, as I suppose I should say, until delivery at 9 months. So why is a baby making enzymes so early? Usually things don't develop until they're needed. The lungs, for instance, aren't ready to go until the last month or two. But pancreatic enzymes are being made way before the baby's going to see a meal to digest. But Beard speculated, if the enzymes are stopping the trophoblast from continuing to invade, then they're vitally important. Because if that trophoblast just keeps going, it could kill the mother. And that's no good for the mother or the baby. So then Beard theorized, okay, maybe pancreatic enzymes could work against cancer. Now, he was not a doctor, so he didn't have access to patients to treat, but there were other doctors who heard about what he was thinking, and they thought, let's give it a try. There were injectable enzymes available in that era. They were used for other purposes, and so various doctors gave enzymes a try for cancer. And there are a number of very interesting case reports in the medical literature from that era of people who got well with these injectable enzymes. But there were other doctors who would try it, and it didn't work. And so Beard's answer to that was very simple. You're not using good quality enzymes. Refrigeration wasn't really available. The way that enzymes were made, there was a lot of possibility for things to go wrong, because these are digestive enzymes, and if you leave them intact to work on each other, in other words, if the product sits around too long before you actually use it, what you can wind up with is enzyme soup, just bits and pieces of enzymes that won't do anything at all. So Beard said, if it's not working, you don't have good quality enzymes. And there was a lot of back and forth in the medical literature in the era. And in 1911, Beard published a book called The Enzyme Treatment of Cancer that summed up what he had learned in various papers and things that had been written about this subject. But around the same time, something else came along that was billed as an easy, effective, non-toxic way of dealing with cancer, and that is radiation. Radiation had a spokesperson, one could say, Madame Curie, a brilliant woman who had won the Nobel Prize twice. And she was articulate, radiation was simple, Beard was inarticulate. According to one of the students that wrote some memoirs, he sounded like one of the most boring men that ever lived. And meanwhile, you know, his work, there was all this argument, did the enzymes work, did they not work, what's the issue, are they stable? Radiation was easy, you didn't have to worry about all those things. And so radiation was billed not only as an answer to cancer, but also as an answer to skin problems. Here's an advertisement for a skin product that would make you beautiful with radiation. And so it would be another 10 or 15 years before people realized that radiation was not non-toxic. In fact, Madame Curie died as a result of radiation poisoning. And it wasn't that effective against cancer for that matter. But in the meantime, Beard had died. His work kind of got washed aside in the general stream of medical information. A few doctors had picked what he had done up over the intervening years, but then Kelly came along and just purely by luck, so to speak, found out that the pancreatic enzymes that he was swallowing seemed to be changing the cancer. Now, he was using oral enzymes. He was swallowing them. Beard and some other practitioners used injectable enzymes. But injectable enzymes haven't been available in this country since the 1960s. Fortunately for Kelly, he found that swallowing them seemed to work just as well. Now, so Kelly had then two parts of his nutritional program. He was following his diet, and he was taking large amounts of pancreatic enzymes, both with his meals to help him digest and between meals to work on the cancer. And things seemed to be going along pretty well for a while until he started to feel sick. He started to get a lot of nausea and muscle aches. His hip was terrible. He was in awful pain. He felt terrible. So he couldn't take his enzymes. He was feeling sick just looking at them. So he stopped taking them for a few days and started to feel better. Then he went back on the enzymes and almost immediately started to get sick. And so he figured he had to figure out something to do, because his theory was the enzymes were creating waste that made his body just feel terrible. Now, he swore that he got the next part of his treatment from something called the Merck Manual. The Merck Manual is a compendium of medical information. It's still out there today. But up until the 1970s, it actually had a procedure in it called coffee enemas. Coffee enemas were in the literature for 100 years before that. They were known as something that could help people feel better. And here is a nursing text with a rather graphic image of how to give a coffee enema, mentioning that coffee enemas could be given as a stimulant. Dr. Kelly found that with the addition of the coffee enemas, he could stay on his pancreatic enzymes. And so that was the final piece of the puzzle for him. The components of the Kelly program, the diet, pancreatic enzymes, and some other supplements, which I'm not going to get into right now, and then coffee enemas. And that were the piece, that was the pieces of what became the Kelly program. With this regimen, he got better. And now I'm taking something that took quite a while and making it sound like it was 5 minutes. It was a long process. But nonetheless, he got better. He put the weight back on, the tumor went away, and he was looking good again and continuing his practice of orthodontics. But what he found was that bit by bit, he was seeing more and more people that didn't want their teeth straightened. They came in and said, "We want to know what you did about your cancer, and can we do it too?" So the nature of his practice changed, and part of it was just word of mouth. You know, the community had noticed this guy that looked like he was on death's door is now looking really good. What did you do? But there were also doctors in the community that would very quietly refer patients to him, and they would say to their patients, "I don't know what he did. I don't want to know what he did. But whatever he did, it seemed to have worked for him, and I can't do anything for you, so why don't you go over and see him?" So his practice changed. And so he was seeing patients. He found over the years as his practice developed that not everyone did well with a vegetarian diet. So one of the things that he developed was different diets for different types of people. I'm not going to get into that because I've only got an hour, but there's other things on our website, for example, that go into that in more detail. But he developed this program. He was finding it to be pretty effective. And he then published a little book called One Answer to Cancer. And at this point, his life got a lot more complicated because orthodontists are not supposed to treat cancer. And so this got him in a little trouble with the medical establishment. He wound up leaving the state of Texas. He moved to the state of Washington, where he practiced for many, many years. And relatively quietly, until a few years later, he got involved in the case of a patient named Steve McQueen. Now, Steve McQueen was a very well-known person. This shot is one in the public domain of Mr. McQueen. It's when he was arrested, I believe, after a fight. But in 1979, Steve McQueen was diagnosed with mesothelioma, which is a very difficult to deal with cancer that's involved with the lining of the lung. And he went to see, you know, regular doctors who gave him regular treatment, which didn't work. And then once he was told there was nothing more that could be done for him, he sought out alternative treatments. He went to Mexico, where he was seen by, among others, Dr. Kelly. McQueen was a terrible patient as far as a lifestyle change kind of treatment goes. He cheated constantly on his diet, and eventually he passed away. And when he passed away, Kelly was vilified in the national media as the quack that killed McQueen. It was a horrible time for him. And it was in the aftermath of this whole thing that he actually met Nick. Nick at the time, Nick Gonzalez, was a second-year medical student. But before he went to medical school, he had actually been a journalist. Started off as working for Time, and then bit by bit, his journalism had veered towards medical nutrition. He had interviewed a number of the greats of the day, like Linus Pauling, Abram Hoffer, Robert Atkins. He had an extensive experience, in effect, interviewing all these people, and then he decided to go to medical school himself. So he was at Cornell Medical School, but he still had a lot of connections in the journalism world. And one of those connections was thinking about writing a book about Dr. Kelly and said, "Can you go talk to the guy and see if he's for real? I just want to know if I should do this or not." So Nick met Dr. Kelly. And he said that Kelly, at the time, he just was really devastated about the whole McQueen thing because he had hoped that if McQueen did well, that could be a springboard to get his work properly investigated, because he felt like he was doing something, or that he was seeing people that were doing very, very well, and he wanted it investigated. So Nick said, "Well, you know, I'm a medical student, maybe I should do it." So he went back and talked to his mentor at the time, a man named Dr. Robert Good, who was the president of Sloan Kettering at the time. And Dr. Good's comment was, "Why don't you go check him out? Even if he turns out to be a total quack, you'll have learned a lot in the process. And people learn more when they do things they're interested in. This is your project, go for it." So Nick went to go through Dr. Kelly's records and investigate him. And by the time the project was over, he had reviewed 10,000 charts by himself, bear in mind, 10,000 charts. He had sent questionnaires to 1,300 of them. He had interviewed 450 at length by phone. He then chose 50 different types of cancer to create a monograph with case reports of people that had done well. And by case reports, I'll keep mentioning this as we go along, but I mean someone who had clear-cut active cancer at the time they saw Kelly, who couldn't have been cured by any other treatment, and who had either extremely long life or resolution of cancer while under Dr. Kelly's care. So he put together a collection of these in a monograph. And so at the time that I met him, he was partway through this project, and he was telling me about some of these cases, and I was amazed. Here's an example, one of the cases from this monograph. A patient with metastatic uterine cancer. She had originally been diagnosed with uterine cancer in 1969, and she had surgery followed by radiation, and she was presumed cured. A few years later, she started to feel sick, kept going back to her doctors, but they didn't really take her seriously until 1975, when they examined her and found that she had a mass in her pelvis. Then they did an x-ray and discovered the reason why she'd been tired and coughing was because she had numerous metastases in her lungs. They took out the pelvic tumor and confirmed that, yes, indeed, the uterine cancer had come back. But there was nothing they could really do about the lung cancers, the spread to the lung. They put her on a synthetic progesterone, which just made her worse, and she stopped it. So then she went to see Dr. Kelly. 11 years later, at the time Nick was wrapping up his research project, she was alive and well. In the interim, she had actually gone to see a doctor. She was having some skipping of her heart and wanted him to check it out. He was completely astonished that she was even still alive. He actually documented that in the notes. He said, "I nearly dropped dead when she walked in the room." And he did an x-ray, and everything was gone. She actually passed away in 2009 at age 95. So she outlived the diagnosis of metastatic uterine cancer by 34 years. She would have been lucky to have lived 34 months with that one. So this is the kind of case that Nick was telling me about, and like I said, I was astonished. But another thing started to happen to me when I was in my third year of medical school. I myself started to feel unwell. I was feeling tired, I was having difficulty concentrating, I wasn't as sharp as I used to be, and by the time I finished my internship, my health had really gone downhill. I was able to finish okay, you know, I finished okay, I passed all my exams, I didn't kill anybody, but I was not feeling well. I knew I needed to do something about it. So I took a breather from my medical training and went on the Kelly program myself to get better, and I did. Meanwhile, Nick was finishing up his research project, and another piece of that research project was to look at all of the patients that Dr. Kelly had treated with the diagnosis of pancreatic cancer during a given time period to see what happened to them. And he divided them into three groups, people that never did a thing that Dr. Kelly said, people that kind of did it, or did it for a little while and then quit, and then people who did everything that Kelly said to do. And he based this partly on interviews with family or patients for the ones that were still alive, and partly based on their supplement orders, because they all bought their supplements from one place, and so he could tell who was buying enough to be swallowing them as directed. And pancreatic cancer was chosen as the one to go through and look at the records, because pancreatic cancer has a fairly uniform outcome. In other words, there are some types of cancer where one patient might do better than another just because one person's disease is more aggressive than another one. But with pancreatic cancer, it's fairly uniform, so it makes it easier to compare from one person to the next. So what he found was that the patients that didn't do a thing that Kelly said had an average survival of 63 days. Now, this was in an era before CAT scans, so diagnoses tended to be made a little later in the process. But nonetheless, that is unfortunately not uncommon with pancreatic cancer to have that be the length of time. With the patients that did it partway, they had an average survival of 302 days. With the patients that did everything everything that Dr. Kelly said, there was an average survival of 8 years. One of those people is still alive. So if I was to recrunch the numbers now, it would be longer. But that's what it was as of the time that the study closed in effect. So Nick put all this material together into his book, and then the next goal was going to be to get it published, either in small pieces as a journal articles or as the book intact. And what he found when he tried to get it published was that he got nowhere. There were two reactions. From medical journals where we're trying to get case reports published, the response most was, well, universally actually, that these cases can't be real. We don't need to look at the records. We don't need to talk to the patients. We don't need to talk to their doctors. We already know it can't be real. Go away. And then there was also some reactions from more typical publishing houses that were approached, and we actually have a letter from one of them that states this. It said, it's an important book. We hope somebody publishes it, but it's not going to be us because we're a big publishing company and we have a medical division, and they would not be happy with us if we published this book. So Nick got nowhere with this. And in the meantime, this was all very, very hard on Dr. Kelly. Dr. Kelly had had a tough life in a lot of ways, and he was hoping that this whole project would help get him, you know, some recognition and get his methods continued. He himself was no longer in practice at that particular point, and he got, to be perfectly blunt, stranger and stranger. He started writing some very odd things, which you can still find on the internet in some places, and he looked like he was never going to practice again. And so Nick and I decided that we needed to try to keep the method alive. We went to New York, where Nick was from. Nick set up a practice and started seeing patients. I continued to work on my own health. Once I got better, I went back, finished my internal medicine residency, got my boards, and then went back to work with Nick again. And just to answer the question, you know, why do I do what I do? Well, it's partly because I myself got better on this treatment. But it's also and mainly because there were only the two of us to do this. And I couldn't morally justify not following up on this. There was only us, and so we did what we had to do. So the goal. So, by the way, Nick's book did eventually get published, so it is in print at this point, pretty much the way it was in the 1986 version, so it is available if anyone's interested. So the goal at this point was to collect case reports and hoping to be able to move forward with research again and to recreate what Dr. Kelly had done. And so Nick was seeing patients there from 1987 forwards in New York. And in 1993, he got an invitation to go to the National Cancer Institute to present what's called best cases. The National Cancer Institute was trying to investigate alternative treatments starting at that point. Now, I'm not saying they were particularly enthusiastic about this concept, but they were getting a lot of pressure from Congress to do something because congressmen were getting a lot of pressure from their constituents. And so they set up the best case series on the grounds that anybody that's doing good work with cancer should be able to present properly documented case reports of people that got better. So Nick and I put together 25 cases, which he then went down to Bethesda to present. This is the headline from a newsletter that they put out at the NIH describing this presentation. And the people at the NCI were actually quite polite, and they listened, and they said, you know, that's pretty interesting. You've got some good cases here. And what we think you should do is you should do a pilot study. And what we would suggest is you do it with pancreatic cancer, because a pilot study doesn't have a control group. It's just a group of patients with a single diagnosis that are followed going forward. And because pancreatic cancer has a fairly consistent outcome, unfortunately, it makes it easier to compare a group of patients with a historical control, so to speak. And they said, you know, if you can get 3 patients to live a year, we'll be impressed, 3 out of 10. And they also said, you know, you'll need an advisory group, you'll need to write a protocol, you'll need funding. We're not going to give you any of that, although we will be willing to look at the protocol if you'll write it and send it to us. So Nick, primarily Nick and I, came up with funding. Nestle actually funded it. Their medical director had become interested in what we were doing. And we got our advisory group and we got our patients and we finished our study that was published in 1999 in the journal Nutrition and Cancer. And what we found was that the patients that were enrolled, there were 11 patients. We had a median survival of 17 months, and it might have been better if some of them had had better cooperation from their local doctors, but that's a whole nother story. And our one-year survival was 81%, our two-year survival 45%, just as a comparison. In a study that was done around the same time that got the drug Gemzar approved for the use in pancreatic cancer, all of the patients were gone at 19 months. So they had no two-year survivors. We had several. So at this point, the National Cancer Institute saw the data again and they said, yeah, we're impressed. The next step is going to be a regular clinical trial where patients would be enrolled into our nutrition arm and simultaneously patients would be enrolled in a chemotherapy arm. And the goal then is to compare how these two groups come out. So the study was funded by the newly formed National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine with supervision from the NCI, the trial site Columbia Presbyterian in New York, and it was set up as, again, a direct comparison of our treatment to patients treated with chemotherapy. This study from the very beginning was a disaster. We had a lot of early warning signs. In retrospect, you know, perhaps we should have moved on. We didn't. We wanted so desperately to make it work, almost like a really bad codependent relationship, I suppose. But the problem really was, you know, the oncology world, and the academic oncology world, I guess I should say, because we're encountering more and more community oncologists that are a bit more open-minded. But the academic oncology world is really not open to this whole concept, and they don't know how to run lifestyle studies. In other words, a lifestyle study is where you're asking people to change the way they live on a day-to-day basis, as opposed to going to a clinic once every 3 weeks to get a medication administered. And there's a big difference in how you run those clinical trials. So that one of the first big problems was that in our pilot study, we had what's called a lead-in period. Because a lead-in period is a four-week period where we just found out whether or not the patients could and would put into practice the treatment protocol they'd been given, because not all of them did. You know, sometimes people just don't want to, they don't or can't change the way they eat. Or in some cases with pancreatic cancer, they may have been overestimating their physical ability to do it, because that particular diagnosis can give people a lot of trouble just getting food down. But regardless, we had that lead-in period in the pilot study, but they wouldn't let us put it in the big clinical trial. And as a result, as you can see here, 11 out of 39 patients on our arm of the study weren't doing it by the time a week was up. And yet those people were counted in the final results as if they'd done our treatment. That's called an intent to treat provision, and it's very common in the medical literature, and there's reasons for it, which I won't get into. But in our particular case, what it meant is that people that never did it were counted against us, in effect, which doesn't seem very reasonable. Another consideration was that patients in the study needed to go see a doctor once a month to get some blood work and to get an exam, just part of the general data collection. And because most of our patients did not live in the New York area, the ones on the nutrition arm, they would go see a local community doctor. Now, we naively believed that those doctors would be perhaps not supportive, but at least neutral, just because the options for pancreatic cancer are not that great. We were wrong. What would happen was that patients would go see that doctor, and if the patient was doing well, the doctors, quite a lot of the time, would say something like, "It's such a shame that you're spending the last months of your life eating this terrible diet." And if the patient was doing poorly, they wouldn't ask questions like, "Well, are you doing the treatment?" or "Can we modify the treatment?" which is what we'd be saying. The doctor would say, "You're doing terrible. You need to get off this treatment immediately." This had some rather negative effects on compliance. And we had no role in patient selection. So if they sent over a patient for us to treat, I mean, we could be talking to them and saying, just based on our experience, this person is not going to do this. But there was nothing we could do about it. So the net result, as you might imagine, was epidemic noncompliance. Out of 39 patients on our arm of the study, 30 of them either did it briefly, incompletely, or not at all. And there were, as you can imagine, a lot of very difficult discussions about this and various meetings that we had. And after one particularly nasty meeting, followed by a series of rather nasty letters, one of the people at NCAM actually wrote a letter. We discussed at considerable length his, meaning Dr. Gonzalez, concerns about the accrual of patients unable to comply fully. Everyone in the room agreed that there is reason to be concerned about it, and it clouds interpretation of the data. Nonetheless, 6 months after this letter was written, the study was closed to further accrual of patients. And eventually, over our objections, a paper was published that ignored completely all the issues with compliance and stated, in effect, that our treatment doesn't work. Now, this was a heartbreaking experience for us. And as you can imagine, I could talk for quite a long time about this topic, but if you want to know the gory details, you may read the book What Went Wrong, which Nick wrote about the clinical trial, which goes on for 600 pages and goes into a lot of detail about it. But you know, we're commonly asked, well, if this treatment is so great, why isn't it Memorial Sloan Kettering? The reality is that it's very, very difficult, I hope you'll understand, to do the kind of study that will persuade the average oncologist that this works, especially when the oncology community is battling you every step of the way in terms of how they interact with the patients on your study to get somewhere. And until there's a little more open-mindedness, I'm not sure we're going to get anywhere with a formal study like this. So what we're doing is continuing to collect case reports. But there's one very, very good thing, actually, that came out of this clinical trial, and she's sitting in the room today. So Ann Cooper was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in February of 2001. She had a cat, and she'll be telling her own story tomorrow in one of the breakout sessions, so you can come hear her flesh this out, so to speak. I'm going to try to keep it short, Anne, to not steal your thunder. But she was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in February of 2001, and she had a biopsy. The slides were read, and they said it's a bad kind of pancreatic cancer, adenocarcinoma, and they sent the slides on to the Mayo Clinic just for confirmation. They said, yes, indeed, it's exocrine pancreatic cancer, the bad kind. So the disease was localized, and it was in a place in the pancreas where surgery was possible. Sometimes that's not the case. There are different locations in the pancreas, and some are right next to the blood supplies. So she could have surgery, and she was told she should have surgery, but she decided not to. And generally speaking, if cancer can be cured by surgery, I'm actually not against it. But in the particular case of pancreatic cancer, I could understand her decision because, first of all, the pancreas is a ticklish organ. It does not like to have operations done on it, and people can get very sick just from the operation itself. It's a big operation. And secondly, it doesn't always cure people. If you take 100 people where the surgeon walked out and said, we got it all, only 25 of those people will be alive in 5 years because for the rest of them, there was microscopic spread of disease before they had the surgery. So it's by no means a guaranteed cure, and the surgery itself can make people very sick or even kill them. And so Anne decided not to get it. And she was then looking for other options. She heard about the clinical trial, thought this sounds perfect. I believe she called our office first, and we referred her over to Columbia where they were doing the screening. She sent all her records to them by fax. They looked at it, said, you look great. So she got on a plane, flew across the country, went to Columbia to sign the papers and get enrolled, and looking at the exact same records that they already had from when she'd sent it to them, they looked at it and they said, well, wait a minute, you could have surgery. Why didn't you get surgery? She said, well, I didn't want it. And they said, well, then you can't be in the study. It's only for inoperable cancer. And she said, but I'm choosing not to get it. What makes me different from somebody else who can't get it? And they said, it doesn't matter. And this may have been partly because they are surgeons that were running the study. And so they felt very strongly, you should get the surgery. And so they wouldn't let her be enrolled in the clinical trial. So she came to my office later that day extremely upset. And I was upset too. I didn't understand their logic at all. But I couldn't put her in the trial. It wasn't in my power to do so. But I could give her a program, and I did. And here she is, 12 years later. So again, our current efforts are to just continue to collect case reports, hoping, you know, that someday perhaps the climate will change more and that we can get another formal study going of some kind. But we're collecting case reports. Again, people with clear-cut active cancer when they started with us, people who couldn't have been cured by their previous treatment, people with evidence of very, very prolonged survival. In other words, I don't mean that they were told they were going to be dead in 12 months and it's 13 months. I'm talking more about 10 years, that kind of case. Now, please bear in mind, we see other types of patients too. Don't feel like you need to be on death's door to come see us. That's not the way that it works. But these are the cases that we're putting together to try to demonstrate the potential of this kind of treatment. To answer the question, several reasons. First of all, there's differences between one cancer's five-year statistics and tell you how people gamed the system, so to speak, part of the reason we don't put them up, why we don't put that kind of information out there. But the biggest issue with these five-year survival type of thing to figure out is compliance. It's a lifestyle change, and not everybody does what they're told. It's just, you know, a reality. Cancer patients are just people, and people sometimes, you know, do things that don't even make sense to themselves, but that's what they do. They're just people. So I'll give you an example to try to illustrate some of these points. This is a gentleman who came to me a few years back. He was diagnosed with kidney cancer in early 2010 when he noticed some blood in his urine. He went to the doctor, they did a scan, and they found that the cancer had already spread, which is not a good sign, because if it's already spread at the time it's found, that would suggest it's more aggressive, potentially. So it had already spread to his adrenal glands and to the lymph nodes in the back of his abdomen. He had the kidney out, because it was, you know, he was having bleeding, so they wanted to do something about that. Had the kidney out, and they offered him various types of standard treatments. He heard the statistics, decided to move on, and he started seeing a local practitioner for a nutritional treatment. 5 months later, he went and got a scan, and the adrenal gland mass had doubled in size, and he now had spread in his liver and in his lungs. So things had moved along. He came to see me in late 2010, and at the time that I examined him, he had a mass in his abdomen that I could feel that was roughly the size of an egg. So he called a few times over the next few months, just a few diet questions, having a little trouble tolerating this and that. But then he came back in for a six-month visit, and I already knew before he even walked in the door that he couldn't possibly be doing his program properly, because all of our patients get their enzymes from one source, and he wasn't buying enough. So if he wasn't buying them, he couldn't be swallowing them. And it turned out when he got there that he actually had some unopened bottles at home, so the net result was he was only taking about half of the enzymes I'd recommended that he take, and he wasn't taking them properly. He was supposed to be separating from his meals, spacing them evenly throughout the day. He wasn't doing either of those things. And he wasn't really following his diet. Just didn't have the motivation to do what he needed to do there. But there was one thing he was doing perfectly, the coffee enemas. My patients never believe it when I tell them that this, for most people, is their favorite part of the program because they feel so much better when they do them. And I know another lecturer will be talking more about coffee enemas later today, but he was doing the enemas perfectly. He loved them because they made him feel better. And when I went to examine him, the tumor that previously was about the size of an egg was more like the size of a cantaloupe. So I'm going to stop his story for just a moment and say, if I'm trying to figure out my five-year survival rates, what do I do with this guy? Do I include him? Well, that doesn't seem fair. He's not doing his program. Do I leave them out? Well, if you start picking and choosing who you put in and who you leave out, it's, again, really easy to game the numbers. And so that's the reason why it just becomes very, very difficult to create anything meaningful. So we're looking at case reports in terms of what can be possible as opposed to that five-year survival type of data. Another consideration might be, what if this guy, you know, he's decided this program isn't for me, he goes off and does something else and he does fabulous. What do I do? Do I leave him out? Do I put him in? I don't know what to do with him. So that's just trying to illustrate that particular challenge. What happened with this gentleman? Well, I wish I could say that I had some magic thing that I spoke to him that inspired him to go home. But in reality, I think that he must have had some will to live, or he wouldn't have gotten on a plane and come to see me in the first place. What I told him, according to my notes, was, you know, you're not doing well, but you're not doing enough of this program to work. And as it stands, you will never know if it would have worked for you. So why don't you go home and do it 100% and then you'll know? Or don't do it at all. That would make sense too. You know, if you don't want to do it, don't do it. But this halfway stuff isn't going to get you anywhere. Do it 100% or don't do it at all. So he went home, and 3 months later I heard from him and he said, I'm doing everything and the tumor's smaller. 6 months later, he wrote me a letter and said, I'm doing everything and I'm doing great and the tumor is 75% smaller. Before this event, I gave him a call a couple of weeks ago just to see how he's doing. I called him up and he said, I am doing great. He said, you know, I realized there were some things in my life I needed to deal with, some relationship issues that I needed to sort out. And he said, you know, as I put that into practice and do something about those things, it is amazing how much better I feel and how much my will to live has improved. And he said, I feel good. I said, great. And I asked him, how's the tumor doing? And he said, you know, I have no idea. He said, I realized it was driving me crazy checking that thing all the time, so I stopped. He said, but I don't know how it's doing, but I feel great and it looked great, so I guess it must be okay. So I hung up the phone. I told him, I'm really glad I called you. I feel better now. But again, that's an illustration of why I do what I do. Because, you know, I can give people the tools to do this work. I've seen it work in others. I can give it to new patients. And many times when they put it into practice, they do well. And we have long-term survivors, people like Ann out, you know, 12 years, people out a long, long time. You know, Nick has got a patient, one of the earliest ones he saw, with inflammatory breast cancer that metastasized to the bones while she was on chemotherapy. She's 25 years out now. And it's that kind of thing that keeps us going. That's kind of the kind of thing that makes me do what I do. So just as a final note, I wanted to mention that there is an article that I wrote several years ago on our website that many people have told me is very helpful. It's called Deciding Whether to Pursue an Alternative Cancer Therapy. So I've got the URL written there for it, and those of you who've got a smartphone and want to try to use the QR code, you can actually go straight to the link itself. So thank you so much for all of your attention, and thank you to Susie and to all of the conference organizers. I think this has been a wonderful event, and I'm looking forward to hearing the rest of the speakers today.